We wrote a very thick report on this, which of course nobody, and still the North, our North is in a sad state of development, but I did, and the report is available from the Service Council.
What was your major result from that report, though? What did you recommend?
Well, I recommend that start cottage industries, and there were a few in operation. But I should tell you that I was brainwashed by Finland. I presented a paper in Helsinki, and then because of this assignment for the Science Council, I insisted that I spend a week in Lapland, and then I saw how the Laps were at just about the same latitude, you know, as the our own North, and how they were, for example, canning caribou meat, doing their own canning, which was a very simple operation after heat treatment, which sold at, in Helsinki, I don't know, $5 a pound. It was a delicacy. And whereas the North, they kill the caribou and that's leave most of the carcasses. They had beads, bead industry, and everything they were giving. It was an example how people with initiative can really function under extreme northern conditions, and if they're proud, make a living out of it, stand on their own. And there's something about the, if you ever have a chance to visit Lapland, it will be really an eye-opener. The way they stand, it's, the way they're dressed, you know, and as well, the way they treat the caribou skins and so on, and the ornaments that they have. And I try to get the people to inject some pride and some design, and so it didn't work. Temporarily, and it was a strange phenomenon, which I certainly I wouldn't want to repeat. In all the localities where we were visiting, I always had some RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police people with me. It insisted on attending council meetings, because everything in these the tribal system, you've got to understand the tribal system, everything depends on getting a council. So, and usually at those council, when I arrived, I found a few people there, whites, standing by, Americans, I must say, and there were counselors. And I told my RCMP, get these guys out. I want to have a frank discussion and not anything influenced by the presence of these so-called counselors, you see. And I don't think those counselors were very effective. What they were trying to do, I don't know. But it was... they were not effective, and if anything, they were detrimental. I tried to get friendly with some of them, and they always came out with grandiose explanations that they want to have the native rights respected, which I agree with, and so on, that we are abusing, and that the waste is only temporary because For example, if you go to Arctic Bay, which is one of the loveliest locations in the high north, it's north of Baffin Island. And what do you see on? You see two things in the north: miles and miles of empty drums, oil drums. They depend on oil, you see, shipped at a cost. I leave it to you. And also dozens and dozens of snowmobiles, which are left abandoned, sometimes for ridiculous reason, spark plugs. They didn't know how to replace them, or batteries, or things like that. The waste was abhorrent to me, you see. So I was preaching and preaching. The situation hasn't changed much. Our north is a very sorry state. And of course, those guys are forever complaining, and they're well supported, you know, by the government. The nurses, the doctors, and this and that, the schools, and is it genetic? It's a huge problem. Anyway, I'd rather not talk about it.
Okay.
I don't think I was effective. I wrote a blistering report, and which should be available actually, if you were interested in it. But yeah. But that's it, the development of the cottage industry.
I have on one occasion been at James Bay.
Oh, yes.
And once at the Iron Ore Company of Canada in Labrador.
Yeah,
no, that's right. Not that far north as you're talking, but that's as far north as I've been in Canada.
Yeah, yeah.
But some, I could identify with some of that with James Bay.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Did you visit some native villages?
Yes, we were out in the where the government had actually built houses for them, and where they had taken the doors and the windows out.
Yeah.
And then we were talking to a Catholic priest who talked about how they would take snowmobiles in the dead of winter and go north.
Yeah.
Survive as their ancestors had.
Yes, I do.
Then there was a British part of the of that area where they had the hospital, and,
yeah.
And so it was an interesting experience.
Yeah, and it's not unique, you know. I met it. I did an awful lot of traveling for Lorena. I traveled a third of my time, mostly in Africa, some of it in Iran, and quite a bit in Turkey, always in connection with the development of properties, copper deposits and things like that, and what had to be done. That was the first wave, and if we made any dent in the possibility of an agreement, then there was a second wave, and those were the money boys. And I was left in the background, you see. But but that was their technique, to send a delegation ostensibly for scientific purposes, but have feelers with what could be developed in and sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. Sometimes it was impossible. You have to understand in most of these countries the importance of a tribal importance. South Africa and in not so much in Zambia, but in Zaire particularly. Anyway.
How did you make that connection with Naranda? How did that come about?
They came to me.
They came to you?
Yeah. I don't know where I got my name, and they approached me, yes. Yeah. Very arrogant and so on. As a matter of fact, I remember once the president was Jack Bradfield. Again, that's not for the record, for Christ's sake. And we were having dinner in Toronto, and I said, Jack, we were talking research and the importance of research, and I was talking, I had a feeling I was talking into deaf ears. I said, well, Jack, why do you want to create an R&D facility for Noranda? Well, he says, you know, we're a big company. They were not that big, no, but they are now. They're a 10 billion company, so nothing to sneeze at. I think I would say largely for prestige. It was dessert time. I said, Jack, I think that completes our conversation for today. I'm afraid I've got to catch Martin. And then I didn't answer his phone calls. That was it. I wasn't going to work for prestige, for God's sake. Yes. But that's from my point of view. It's really the... And now you can... it's 2 minutes from here. You see that research center now. And they've, again, when I was there, I doubled the size, and now they doubled it again. It's a monster now. It's, well, relatively for Canada, it's a monster.
And what was their principal thrust in research when you were there?
Improve the efficiency of the present operations, find byproducts from their current operations, and don't look at other things. Don't bother me with titanium, for example. I did a project, actually a PhD project, and I must say to their credit, partial credit, that they hired my student, a bright Greek. We had developed a method of producing titanium metal very cheaply using plasma technology. And Noranda had a good year, and the research center was being expanded. So I said, okay, we'll give it a try. So they hired Peter, he had his PhD by then, and they gave him $2 million for 2 years. Go ahead and develop that technology. And he made good progress until the 1991 budget was finally hammered out. It's a very painful process, incidentally. And titanium was not on the program. And Peter was asked to resign as of the end. And he had made a very sizable project to develop titanium aluminate, which commands a very high price. That was the first step in making titanium metal. He had developed that and patented it. And I said, we're not interested in going any further. I said, titanium is not a metal. The only metal that they allowed me to, exotic metal that they allowed me to develop, was molybdenum. And there, again, the plasma process, very cheap. And we decided to have the first plant built in near Ghent, Belgium, where we had good contact with the Saracen people. And then the stainless steel business collapsed. That's about 7 or 8 years ago. And it did collapse. And molybdenum, that main use was to strengthen high-strength, low-alloy steel, specialty steel, stainless, and so on. So molybdenum was no longer in demand, in large demand. So they said, okay, we don't... The plant was only $40 million or something like that. For Noranda, that's nothing, you know. And, so that is the one deviation from the accepted path.
Well, the plasma technique, the plasma process as an engineering process, as a chemical engineering process, has a lot of applications, many of which you've developed.
No, not that time. Developed. That it's developing slowly. It's a new technology, and the companies, even American companies, are reluctant. Well, they took an awful lot of my ideas, and that's the eternal story. But I latched on with a company in England, Davy McKee, in Stockton-on-Tees, in the northeast of the UK. And I admired their guts. They bought our patents against my patents, and I had it as a counselor. And then when I worked for Hydro-Québec, hands off. So we were in a very good contacts. And they're up to about 5 megawatts in Australia. But it is tough selling.
There's an article in, this is from Chemical Week in 1985, about the commercial promise of plasma processing. Your name is mentioned a few times.
Yeah.
And there seems to be some some disagreement as to how commercially promising this process really is.
Yeah. For certain things, it's excellent. For certain things, it's to make the cadmium and vanadium, for example, or zirconium, that's another terrific metal, zirconium metal, but not the zirconium that they use in our nuclear industry. Zirconium is very important for the CANDU, you see, but then it has to go through a very expensive purification process to remove the hafnium. Strangely enough, zirconium is always associated with hafnium, which is exactly twice the atomic weight. And you would say, geez, it's a cinch, eh, to separate zirconium from hafnium. Like hell, it's unbelievable. Their boiling point half a degree apart. Solubility is just sheer hell. So I say, well, why not use zirconium metal with hafnium for other purposes? I could make zirconium metal with hafnium for a couple of bucks a pound. It's a terrific metal, high temperature resistance and so on. Nobody matched on.
Now, the peat processing, did you develop that? You had a number of papers on that.
Yeah, naturally.
Is that ever developed commercially into anything?
No, it is developed in Finland. They came to see the process, and they're using it now. Yeah, peat is a very good material. It's
but not here.
No.
Why? Is there a reason for that? Is it just not economically feasible?
No, it's economic, but it's a gamble that people and the big people are unwilling to take. It's tough to make a buck with that. Really. Advanced technology. We had a big program at Miranda on fiber optics. I staked a lot on this back in the 70s. I guess saw a great future, and we really had a bit of an advance. And then said, it's ridiculous. The president said, here we have copper as a conductor, the best conductor in the world, and there you tell me that fiber optics will replace our copper? Are you nuts and all that? So I went out for a couple of years, and it came down again. I've had my moments of despair, you know. Yeah. And we would have been leaders, but we needed millions of dollars. And once our first $5 million was expanded, I went back for about 50. I said, let's put it. The answer was no.
The application of plasma techniques to there's so many different things, but disposal waste disposal techniques, has that caught on?
Yeah.
Is that?
Partly, yes. Mainly in France. I was consulting a bit for EDF, Electricité de France. And I've developed several techniques, again based on my knowledge of AST, the atomized suspension techniques, spraying in presence of a plasma flame. And now I'm approached very strongly by companies right now. One in particular, Godfrey Aerospace, they would like to get a contract. They have been approached of a contract for the Hibernia platform, and also, strangely enough, for frigates and destroyers and so on in Canada for the disposal of waste. In other words, human waste, largely, and all that. I refuse to do that. I know how to do it, and to hell with it. I don't want to have my friends, "Hey, Bill, you're very active again, eh? What are you doing?" "I am treating SHIT. That's not very exciting. Need it, perhaps, but... I built one, mind you, for our little community in Beaconsfield. It was an impressive looking tower, about 25 feet high and big, in which we were handling the sanitary sludge. But we needed an engineer on duty, let's face it. It was, that technology cannot just go by. I was enthusiastic, and I told them that was sufficient. It's a good thing. Shudder. "Oh yes, Bill Gova, yes. I remember you work in Beacons." I feel like disappearing through the floor.
What is the
I don't know what the hell you can make of them all these stupid comments.
You'll see. How do you assess the state of education in chemical engineering in Canada today? I mean, do you attract students, or getting people to go into the field, native Canadians?
Chemical engineering at McGill is in number 4. Let's see, first, I'm sorry, I've got to count on my fingers. First is definitely electrical, mechanical, civil, chemical, in fourth position. Our classes are one quarter of, for example, electrical. An average graduating class in chemical engineering is around 20 people. So it's no big shake. It's bigger at U of T. And yet our people are in great demand. But somehow we're not doing enough of a promotion job among young high school kids to take up that profession. And yet, once I get that degree, all my PhDs, I have one right now. He completed his work, splendid piece of work, plasma again, the recovery of chemicals and energy from Kraft black liquor. It's a monstrous problem. A good program. He completed his work 2 years ago, and then because of his energy and his will, I allowed him to take a job. Fascinating job. It took him 2 years. That was a mistake of my life. He finally completed his under duress. Under duress, everybody got, including the principal. David meeting me at the campus. How about Stewart's thesis? Do you know that you're breaking all the rules? And so on. So finally, he presented it last week. That's one thing, that's one error that we shouldn't make. It's an example of, here is a guy, he hasn't written his thesis, he's already offered a job. I got requests from England for some of my boys. They all find jobs even before they completed their work, they're approached and so on.
Why would U of T have more students when your program's ranked higher?
Pardon?
Your program is ranked higher than U of T's.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
They,
you're right.
They get more students.
Yeah.
Are most of your students from Quebec? Are they... Where do you draw students from?
That's a good... I should say that we have a lot of Asians. Maybe 20%. We have a surprising number of girls, maybe 10%. We have very few Americans. I'm talking about undergraduate training. And the rest are Canadians, yeah. Quebec and Ontario and the rest.
So it's considerably localized then?
Yes, very.
What about at the graduate level?
Graduate level, Murray is doing a fantastic job. Murray Douglas, I mean. And I'm no longer active. That's my last graduate student, I told him. I'm spinning my wheels on this, and it demands too much of my time. I'm trying to promote the university industry projects. And I have one going on in which I'm going to act as a technical director. It's one of my ideas to make silica, fume silica. And that's going to be paid by a small company. They want to upgrade their production of silica. And it will be done at McGill. This is a sort of thing that I'm promoting. I definitely want to slow down.